The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Tim will be here for news today, but I'm going to fly solo for right now. First order of business is Happy Thanksgiving. Hope you all had a great week since our last show. And remember, there are 29 days until Christmas and Hanukkah. Interestingly enough, they fall at the same time this year. So our second order of business is the business of cycling in the state of Ohio. Many of you have ridden or know about several of the big events that are produced by an organization called Columbus Outdoor Pursuits here in the state of Ohio. Included in them are the Tazrov Ride, which will have its 56th straight year in 2017, GOBA, which is the Great Ohio Bicycle Adventure, the week-long family ride that usually takes place right after school, that's out in June, and the Columbus Fall Challenge, with challenge being the operative word. Columbus Outdoor Pursuits, or COP, as it's usually known, has had a super tough year. The director of cycling events, Bill Gordon, passed away while he was riding right before GOBA and threw the organization into panic for a short time, but all the other people stepped up to take the reins and the show went on. Other factors have served to deplete the reserves of the organization, which also runs boating, backpacking, running, climbing activities, and more. And longtime newsletter editor Ann Gerkins had to be laid off. All of this is to say that COP, which is a nonprofit organization, has begun a 2017 fund drive to keep all the activities in Ohio going on into the new year. And if you'd like more information or would like to make a donation, this is a good time of year to think about that. You can go to outdoor-pursuits.org/donate. So in the interest of making your holiday gift giving a bit more exciting, I got to take a virtual trip to Mallorca, Spain this week to speak with Guy Andrews. Guy is a journalist and writer. He's the founder of Ruler Magazine and the editor of a new hardbound coffee table book titled Greg LeMond, Yellow Jersey Racer. The book is stunning. It is a large, beautifully bound book. It's colorful and informative. It unfolds Greg's career from 1977 through 1994. The book is filled with many before unseen photographs, punctuated with stories from each period of his career by a variety of people involved, including Sean Kelly, Ron Kiefel, Chris Boardman, and Shelley Versus, the soigneur with whom we spoke earlier this year. Guy will be with me in the second half of the show. First, however, I am pleased to be able to speak with author, journalist, and editor-in-chief of Bicycling Magazine, Bill Strickland. Bill's depth of knowledge of the bicycle world and his unique style of reporting it from his book 10 Points Through the Editorial Command of the Popular Magazine are somewhat legendary. Recently, he published a transcript of his conversation with Richard Sachs, and his commentary was as entertaining, interesting, and refreshing as Richard's answers. It made for some great reading. We'll try to cover several topics, but I'm hoping he has enough fun with us today that he'll come back and talk with us again in the future, because I know he has a lot to say and we probably don't have enough time to cover it all. So let's head on out to Emmaus, Pennsylvania, where Rodale's Press is headquartered, and welcome Bill Strickland to the Outspoken Cyclist. Bill, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's going to be a good talk.
I think it will be a good talk, and happy holidays.
You too.
Thank you. So, you know, there's a lot known about you, and I'm hoping to maybe discover some things that are unknown, but we'll find out. You're the editor-in-chief of Bicycling. You liked it better when you were editor-in-charge. Why is that?
This is my second time as editor-in-chief, and this time I actually am having more fun than the last time.
Oh, how come you're having more fun now?
It's the staff. We had a situation where I had to hire a lot of staff, and we were able to hire a really diverse group of cyclists in terms of like how they like to ride and their interests and where we're all from and age and gender. We're 50-50 male-female staff right now, which I think is really cool.
I think that is very cool, especially with all the discussion about getting more women into the bike shop over the past few years.
I think, the women are out there, right? When I look back and think about all the people I see riding, you know, not necessarily on these sort of like hard training rides, although where I live, there are a lot of women who do those. But when I think about just people I see out riding, there have always been women out there. I just, especially in the media, I think they haven't been represented.
I would tend to agree. Certainly, I try to be an equal opportunity interviewer here and try to interview a lot of women from all parts of cycling. You know, people like Inga Thompson, people like Siri Lindley is going to be on the show, world-class triathlete, a whole bunch of people. I want to talk about your writing because it is really good, and I appreciate good writing. I love to read good writing. And your recent transcription of the interview you did with Richard Sachs, E. Richie, as we like to call him, your commentary and questions were almost as interesting as his answers, in my opinion.
I mean, I don't know. He's a pretty intriguing character. We went into that together, knowing that we wanted to try almost to collaborate and create something that would sort of work together from his side and my side to sort of not just be an interview, but to be kind of a little event where, like you say, both sides might work to illuminate something.
I thought it was charming. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed reading it. Let's begin kind of at the beginning for you. How did you discover cycling? And as opposed to just riding a bike, what did it mean to you? So something changed for you about cycling. It became something from just riding a bike to something else.
I had a kind of a tough childhood, and a friend of mine got caught driving his car. He was drinking, and his parents took away his license. Like, this is a whole different era, right? Like, the police didn't take away his license. They just called his parents. And they took away his license for months and months. I think it was like a year or something. And he went out and bought a Nishiki road racing bike. And it just seemed like the most exotic thing I'd ever seen in my life. It was really light and it was shiny. And I wanted one of those. And I was also at a point in my life, we were juniors in high school, a point in my life where I sort of wanted to just escape and get away from where I was. And somehow in my mind, that just all the idea of riding a bike like that became connected with sort of escaping who I was and trying to be someone better. And so that was it. I started riding with him on the crappy bike I had. And then I bought a used Schwinn Paramount. I'd been working all summer as a bricklayer's assistant, and I took the money and bought that bike. And it was supposed to be to go to university, and my parents were going to kill me for doing that.
In the end, they probably are not as unhappy as they could have been.
No, I still, you know, my mom still is like, you should have kept that money. You know, she still doesn't quite get how important that was to me.
Yeah, my dad never quite understood how I got in the bike business, and he just didn't get it. He just didn't get it. So, when did you see writing as a career for you? Were you always a writer? Did you always like to write, even as a kid?
As far back as I can remember, it was, you know, along with sort of astronaut and firefighter, writer was something I always wanted to be. But it was one that sort of came true for me in a way. So,
oh, you think in a way? that's putting it very humbly, I must say, really, because I think that your work is is excellent. I want to talk about this book 10 points in a little bit, but I had to read an article, an interview with you to find out about this book. And then I went back to your site and the book's right there and you can read a chapter of the book. It's really, really interesting. Anyway, I like the way your work and cycling are sort of intricately intertwined. So do you think cycling informs your writing, or does your writing inform your cycling, or how do they work together? Because obviously you look at your whole life as writing and cycling somehow.
Does writing inform cycling and cycling inform writing? The answer is yes. I like to ride alone. It's like the only time I ever get to be alone. And when I do that, I get out there, not right away, but you know, when you get to the point where you're just not really thinking anymore, you know, you're just sort of riding your bike. And that's when writing starts to happen for me. And so also just the especially in 10 points, I knew going into it, I wanted to give the writing like a physicality. I wanted to sort of really write it the way that writing felt. And I worked hard at that and succeeded here and there. You know, sometimes when I go back and read parts of it, I'm like, man, I was trying hard there, wasn't I? But, you know, there are parts of that I think I really achieved it. And so I'm pretty happy. And that book changed a lot for me and how I wrote.
For those listeners who haven't heard of it, just give us a real quick synopsis of the book, what it is that 10 points means and meant, and what it changed for you.
Yeah. So I had, you know, like I said before, I had a really tough childhood. I had an abusive childhood, physically and mentally and emotionally abusive childhood, toward the extreme end of what that means. And when I finally had a family and we had our daughter, I was deathly afraid that I was going to turn into my father. And, I was like, is this like something that's inside me, and am I not going to be able to stop it? And is this, I'd always had that fear my whole life. I could, you know, I didn't want to be who I was raised to be. But when I had a daughter, suddenly the stakes were really high. It wasn't just my life. It was this amazing kid who I loved more than anything. I was terrified. And I started riding more and more and more, you know, to kind of cope with all that, right? My daughter was 4 and I was doing this local training race, which has because it's an open race and we happen to have, there's like a lot of Olympians and pros and world champion track racers and stuff here. So it's a pretty fast race. And it's a points format. You score points every 3 laps. And I scored a point. I mean, you know, it was like this miracle that I scored this point. And my daughter was there and I was like, I scored a point. And she was like, Dad, next year you're going to score 10. And I knew it was something I couldn't do. It would be impossible for me to score 10 points. And I don't know how this worked, but I suddenly decided that if I could score 10 points, do this impossible thing, then I could also be a good father, which also felt impossible to me. And so it became, the book is about the year I spent trying to score 10 points.
Did you score 10 points?
I did not. I didn't. I failed.
But you became a great father. So I think you won, right?
Well, yeah, I'm not great. You know, I'm passable, I think, you know, so far so good. So,
nobody said, okay, you're a terrible father yet, Bill. Right.
Right. I mean, my daughter's 18 now. She was 5 when I was writing, you know, in the season that book is.
I had no idea of the year that the book was published. I mean, this could have been last year for all I knew. That's interesting that she's 18. That was 14 years ago because you said she was 4 when I read what I read.
Right. So we've gone through a lot together.
Yeah, well, I would say so. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with editor-in-chief of Bicycling Magazine and author and journalist and cyclist, Bill Strickland. So you have been involved in some really interesting projects with people like Lance Armstrong and Johan Bruneel at a time when, you know, people might think, wow, racing, you know, it was in its heyday and yet was coming to this unbelievable screeching halt. You had to make a bunch of decisions about what you were writing. How were you able to write what you wrote knowing that things were going to change? Because I think you did know in some cases that things were not as they seemed.
So at a certain time, I knew I'd always describe myself as an agnostic. You know, I think you would have to be really dumb or really, really hopeful to never suspect that Lance Armstrong had doped. There was so much out there. On the other hand, I would talk to people and they would tell me this or that. And I would say, well, let's go on the record. Can you do this? And no one, for years and years and years, no one would ever go on the record. And then I got to know Lance, and it's a cliche, right? But he's very persuasive when you're there talking to him and he's looking at you. He was a really good, powerful liar. When I look back at that period, I'm like, I knew, but I didn't know. And so I just decided, I guess I'm not going to know until I know, right? If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I get it. I mean, you have to write the story you're writing.
Right. And so I always treated it, I would give both sides. And so for years, everyone hated me because the people who loved Lance, this was before he admitted doping, the people who loved him hated me because I would always say, but we don't know. And the people, you know, his fierce critics, the people who didn't like him, would hate me because I wouldn't say he doped. So I chose the worst position possible.
Walking that thin line. Wow. Once that exposure was made on Oprah and everybody knew and he was admitting and whatever it was, did people change what they thought about your writing, about what you did? Or were people like, well, he kind of towed the line and just waited it out?
Well, yeah. So I actually didn't. I was ahead of the USADA report. I wrote a cover story for Bicycling about a year before that came out. When I finally knew he had doped, you know, without a question, 100% certain, there's no more agnostic. I had what I considered proof. And, I went to him and told him, hey, we're going to say this. And, I sent him the story before it came out. Once it was written and in the magazine, but not yet, shipped to the public, I sent it and I said, this is going to come out. You need to know this. And, changed my relationship with him and all those guys. And, for a while, yes, I was sort of a little better liked by, Betsy Andreo and people like that. But it's still, I look back, it's just such a bitter period for so many people. And a lot of people just, they still want you to draw really strict sides, black and white sides. And it's always been very gray for me.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, I guess going into it, I like Betsy. I ended up developing a really, I would say, a friendship with her, a really close relationship. And I have a friendship with Lance and, Michael Berry, I ended up being very close to. And I know George and, of course, I knew Runea. So I know all these characters. And the way I think of it now is like we were all in a plane crash and we survived and we kind of look back and we have this bond, even though, we maybe don't like each other.
Yeah, it's interesting what might be holding you guys together, right? So,
right.
Let's talk about the state of bicycling here in the States, because obviously people in Europe look, unless they are on the pro end or unless they are on the Netherlands, we ride our bike every day. What are you talking about, end? It's very different here in the States. And so I know you get to have sort of an interesting perspective because your magazine sort of is the all-come magazine. It's for anybody who's interested in cycling, regardless of whether they're avid cyclists or brand new to the sport. What do you think is going to be viable going forward when we have such a problem with angry drivers, expensive entry points, and kind of the chaotic approach that the industry takes? Do you have any ideas how to keep people engaged in the sport?
I do. I mean, I don't know. Let's see what happens with our governmental changes coming up. I felt like and still hope that we've hit a turning point in that major cities realize cycling infrastructure is good for the city. I talked to a lot of these mayors and bicycle coordinators and people who have the power to move things, and they've realized that. I always tell them, bicycles and indicator species. There's those frogs, and if the frogs start dying, you have an unhealthy pond. If a city has bicycles, it's a sign that there's a really vibrant community and that they're investing in the infrastructure and that they're able to attract a creative class and they're able to attract a more youthful demographic. And we've seen that all these things are true. Like again and again and again, we see whether it's New York or Chicago or wherever it is, that businesses that are near bike lanes, especially separated ones with their own infrastructure, business increases. We've seen that the roads become safer for every user, for drivers, pedestrians, and cyclists. And we've seen that drive times go down, car drive times I'm talking about. When you put in a bike lane, the cars actually move better. And so it's the proof is there. It's undeniable. And my sense is we're going to get there and it's going to happen, but it ain't easy, right? There's backlash, what I'm seeing right now. And a part of certainly with the dangerous roads, I think we're part of a bigger thing, which is, you know, traffic fatalities, vehicular fatalities are higher, not just for cyclists, but for everyone than they've been. I forget what the stat I saw is, but, you know, it's at least 10 years. I think the stat was maybe 20 years. And a lot of that seems to be due to texting and mobile phones. Right?
Yeah. Distracted driving. Right. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's really bad.
Right. This sort of slaughter of cyclists needs to stop. And a lot of that is enforcement. A lot of it's education. Hopefully it's technology. You know, I'm all for driverless cars. Like bring those things on. Right.
You're not going to get an argument from me. I'm afraid to ride on the streets anymore. You know, I mean, I ride the back of a tandem. I don't even ride a single anymore. But I'm like, no, let's go on the trail. You know, let's go to the towpath. Let's go to the bike and hike. I don't want to ride on the streets. It's kind of terrifying. Can we talk a little bit about equipment? Because your magazine, of course, does lots of reviews, right? Bikes and equipment. I come from the era of the late 70s, early 80s, 90s, you know, when we had steel bikes and we had sport touring and index shifting was just starting to happen. Now, to me, it's all like same, same. You got lots of carbon fiber and you got, you know, all these frames look similar and one bike looks like the other bike. How are you able to review these bikes to make them exciting for new riders? And also, they're very expensive right now. It's a high entry point.
It is a high entry point. I think that's one of the things that we talk a lot about in the cycling industry. You know, so first, there's the enthusiasts, right? Which, you know, those people, they don't want to spend less than $1,000. You know, it's a big, important part of their life. They're like, you know, musicians want good guitars, right?
Right.
They don't have to have the best guitar, but they don't want to go to Kmart and get their guitar, you know, get a toy guitar. So the enthusiasts, I get it. What I would like to see is better bikes available to more people. And, you know, there's some cool things going on that Detroit Bikes, you know, which is production right there in Detroit. And their goal is to make bikes for regular people, not for cyclists. And I think that's a cool thing. I think if the infrastructure develops more, people are going to want bikes, you know, the way they have bikes in Europe. They're not they certainly have racing bikes and there are enthusiast bikes. And look, those are cool. I love riding a really great bike, right? A really great racing bicycle. But I also like town bikes. And whether that ends up being used bikes or we have some other way to deliver those to people, I think that's going to happen if the demand is there.
Do you think the demand is there?
The demand's not there yet.
So what about carbon fiber? Do you think it's going to just – is something ever going to take over from – because I mean, I watched steel turn to a kind of aluminum and then it was aluminum and a little bit of carbon and now it's like carbon fiber all the way down. Are you seeing anything – now, Detroit Bikes is steel. Link, you know, the new Link bikes are steel. Waterford still builds steel. Seven builds titanium. But carbon, everybody wants a carbon bike.
Yeah, well, that just seems to be the wonder material, right? Especially for the high end and especially for the designers, the way they're able to tune it. And they can, you know, once you get sort of the molds and you get the workforce trained, it's pretty reliable way to produce something really high quality. You know, with steel, still kind of relying on that craftsman, right? Like I think you can get, you know, I've laid up carbon fiber. I've been there and I've like taken a little sheets and undone the adhesive back and put it in the mold. And it sucked when I did it. But, you know, I could see that the other people doing it had just like laid enough sheets in the mold that they could do it. And so it's with like a modicum of training, you can get a really great carbon fiber bike as long as you have the engineers.
Right.
Whereas to make a great steel bike, you know, that's years and years and years of dedication to that craft, right?
Yes. My husband's a frame builder.
Yeah, right. So different thing than me. You know, that said, I think the Tarmac, Specialized Tarmac, is maybe the best road bike in the world. You know, it's an incredible road bike in terms of just all around what you can do on it. But my two personal bikes, I own a Breadwinner and I own a Stümper cross bike. Oh, sorry, three, and a Pegoretti. And those are all steel bikes.
Funny, huh?
I love steel.
Steel is still real.
Yeah, it's the modern steel and the way they're building it. I'm testing a bike from Giovanni Badalin, who wants to start bringing steel bikes into the country. And that,
why, I haven't seen that name in years.
Right, yeah. So he wants to come back. And I got to spend some time with him over there and look at it. He's still using the machines that he used in the 80s and 90s to build his steel bikes. You know, he kind of shelved them when aluminum came along and when carbon fiber came along. And his son is old enough now that he's taking a part in the company. And he and his son figured out that what we should really do is not try to compete as a commodity with these carbon bikes, but go back to what we do best, which is steel. And that bike is unbelievable. It is fantastic.
It was always a beautiful. Well, you know, the Italian bikes, there was just something special about them. All right, we got to change the subject because we're going to have to wind this down. I mean, I could sit and talk with you all day. That would be really fun. I want to know a little bit about Bicycling Magazine as the entity itself. Print is becoming less and less desirable, and people are going to online. However, you know, I still read books. I still prefer magazines. Tell me what bicycling looks like. Print versus digital right now?
That's a great question. And I love talking about this because this is a horrible time for print. Very challenging, right?
Yep.
But to me, it's a real opportunity because it gives you a chance to really think like, well, what do people want for print? And is print going to be around? And if it is around, what's the purpose of print going to be? And you know, what we believe here at Bicycling is that print is sort of done as a commodity. Print's not something that you use anymore or the place you go to get information. What print should be, we believe, is especially when you subscribe and when it comes to your house, like it's coming right into your house. We're like a friend, right? And we want it to be an immersive, experiential thing. And we've made changes in the past 2 years to move the print magazine in this direction where it's about the experience of being a cyclist. And we've put a lot more people in there and all kinds of different cyclists. And we're letting them really show everyone else what cycling is and to share that with everyone else. You know, it used to be that in bicycling, when I first started here, 1991, you know, every 4 months we'd be like, well, we got to do an article about how to change a flat. You know, it's been time for that because people don't happen to get the magazine that month. It's going to be hard for them to find that information. Well, now, of course, if you have a flat, you just type into the Google search bar, how do I fix a flat? So, you know, this idea that magazines are the place where you're going to get information, I think is past. You know, we see that as what digital is for. Very much we want people to use our site and sort of live within our magazine.
Nice. That's a really good way to explain it. I like that. Are subscriptions down?
So far, so good. So since we've made these changes, we've had the subscription picture has been really good for us.
Good.
Really positive, and it's up from where it was, which is really nice. And at the same time, we've spent a lot of our energy and focus on our website. And so that you know, so it's like every month we break another record on traffic on the website. So that's been really good too. That's part of why it's really, really fun to be at Bicycling right now. It's working really well right now.
Can't get much better than that. Last question. Well, actually, I have a couple. Are you personally working on any new projects right now?
You know, I am. I started a new project and I'm just getting into it and I'm not sure how it's going, but trying to put together some sort of long form writing. When I took over as editor in chief again, all the writing sort of dropped off for me. It's been really hard. It was a big change for me, And I didn't write anything substantial. You know, I wrote some reviews here and there for the magazine, but I didn't really write anything for about 2 years. And I'm sort of figuring out how to carve out time and do that now. So hopefully we'll see where this goes.
We will, because I'll keep watching. And I have a big mouth, and I talk every single week to people, like, through this medium. So three more questions. What's your favorite food?
Well, yeah, you know, it changes, right? If I had to pick a style, I would say Mexican. My grandfather was Mexican, and, you know, we lived in Indiana. He was, this is, you know, very timely. He was actually, an illegal immigrant who swam across the river and ended up in Chicago at a meatpacking plant. And so I grew up in Indiana, you know, eating. He taught my grandmother how to cook really great Mexican food, and she taught her daughters, and so we would have this awesome. It's like comfort food for me.
Heck
so
yeah,
Mexican food.
What's your favorite music?
I like jazz.
Me too. Good for you. Who's your favorite jazz musician?
I'd have to say Monk, just because you know, Richard Saxon. I talked about that a little bit, just because he just sort of what he did to the music and the way he thought and what he was able to get out of the other musicians, I think is just amazing to me.
All right. Last question. Any pets?
Oh yeah. We have, we're down now.
Okay.
We have still two dogs and four cats. We live on 5 acres, but you know, we've had goats in the past and a lot more cats. And my daughter was, you know, always bringing in animals.
Well, you know what? This has just been delightful, as I knew it would be. And I really appreciate you taking time right before the holidays to talk with me. And I hope we get to talk again.
Yeah, this was really fun.
Great. Well, thanks so much. And till next time, have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bill Strickland joined me from the office of Bicycling Magazine in Emmaus, Pennsylvania, where he is editor-in-chief. What an interesting conversation. I really could have talked with him all day. We are going to take a break. We're going to have a little bit of news, and then we will head on out to Mallorca, Spain, to speak with Guy Andrews. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Opening on November 4th and running through December 16th, the Cleveland Institute of Art presents Living Dangerously, an exhibition featuring paintings by American artist Angela Dufresne and drawings of British-born Nicola Tyson. Living Dangerously confronts the risks of walking the line between figural and abstract work. This exhibition is open to the public at CIA's Rheinberger Gallery, 11610 Euclid Avenue in University Circle. Hours and more information at cia.edu/events.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we have time for a little bit of news. This comes from Streets Blog USA by our friend Angie Schmidt and Ben Fried. Now, we know that infrastructure is allegedly sort of the key to jobs and to keeping the economy moving forward and, you know, getting that person back to work who up until now hasn't had a job because jobs were sent overseas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're going to see a lot of stories about Donald Trump and infrastructure in the next few months, and this reporting will be heavily influenced by a message that has been honed and perfected by the American Society of Civil Engineers. Already, leading congressional Democrats like Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are saying they want to work with Trump on infrastructure, reflecting a common viewpoint that infrastructure is a bipartisan issue. The situation is dangerous for several reasons, including the likelihood that the transportation components of Trump's infrastructure plan will be heavily tilted toward roads. Now, remember, this is not us talking. This is Streets Blog. America does have a very real infrastructure need. There's a lot of truth to the general sentiment that things like roads, transit networks, and water systems are in need of repair. But these needs tend to arise as much from the way public agencies spend the funds at their disposal, allocating too much to road expansion, not enough to maintenance, for instance, as they do from a lack of funding. Key to the view that Schumer and Pelosi espouse is the messaging of the American Society of Civil Engineers, whose infrastructure report card claims the U.S. needs to spend trillions of dollars more on infrastructure. So the article goes on. It's from Thursday, November 17th, Streets Blog USA. It is an interesting take on how infrastructure may or may not be addressed in the coming administration.
Well, Chicago's best known for all of its windiness when it comes to politics,
that
right?
That is true. yes.
Someone has proposed a floating cycling path that would connect nearly 30 Chicago neighborhoods. It's called the River Ride Path, and it will be installed on the north and south branches of the Chicago River. This means it would run parallel with some of the city's busiest traffic routes, helping to alleviate congestion on the roads and on existing cycling paths. It's claimed that it would also provide safer routes for cyclists within the cities. Total project will cost $5 to $10 million per mile.
And how many miles are they talking about?
Well, they're talking about connecting 30 different cities. They're talking about adding just one section to sort of a pilot program to see how that works, but that's a lot of money per mile. But if it takes a lot of people off of and makes them safer from the roadways, then that works out a whole lot better. The interesting thing is I looked at the project itself. It's a floating dock, sort of.
I wonder if it moves when you ride.
It's covered. It moves up and down, but I don't know that one or two people on their cycling would create that much of a movement with that. I'm curious to see how it would work out in the wintertime. This is something that obviously would never work in Cleveland because the Cuyahoga River is so twisty, it would never work here.
Right.
Chicago would be a great place to try this, and I'd be curious to see if this will work. I think it'll be a fun project.
Well, we'll keep our eye on it. This comes from Bike Radar. It is gift-giving season, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Smart trainers are reviewed by Bike Radar on November 15th. And they say, we put data-rich, power-sensing, avatar-racing smart trainers through their paces. The article starts, it started with phones, moved to TVs. Now it seems like everything has to be smart these days, including turbo trainers. Having something to entertain or guide you while you're slugging your guts out on your own makes sense. And having accurate feedback on your power or even control on required power is invaluable for training. But what companies mean by smart can vary. Some units are ANT plus, so need a dongle to connect to your phone, tablet, or computer, but can link to most bike computers. Some are Bluetooth only, so can connect to the electronic devices without a dongle, but can't connect to most cycling computers. The CycleOps comes in either ANT or Bluetooth. Others are smart enough to communicate in both protocols, so you can connect to whatever device you want. There are two main selling points for smart trainers. They are both centered around interactivity. By measuring power and cadence, smart trainers can animate both virtual riding games like Zwift and facilitate specific training with programs like Trainer Road. This can also be done with a regular trainer and a power meter, though. The cool thing about smart trainers is that the third-party software like Zwift and the Trainer Road can control resistance as you ride. Hit a hill in Zwift and all of a sudden you are really having to grind out the power. Come to a rest interval in Trainer Road and the power required immediately drops to the prescribed level. So there are things to consider, and it goes on and gives you a whole bunch of information, and then it actually reviews each of the trainers on a 1 to 5 scale. So again, it's Bike Radar from November 15th reviewing turbo trainers for the holiday season.
So how soon are we going to see our shut up legs bit of software that goes with one of those?
Yens?
Yes.
I don't know. What an interesting idea.
Well, haven't we had the indoor trainer for several years that was the Tour de France model that would give you...
Well, that's Le Mans.
Right.
Yeah.
And it would give you all of the... It gives you all of this, but it doesn't give you the interactivity that goes with it. And now that Jens is retired, he has all of these other fun things that he's been doing, and I think trying to keep up with him would be a lot of fun.
Right.
This comes from Taiwan. The global slump in bicycle sales, especially in the U.S. and China, has taken its toll on Giant's first three quarters of 2016, with overall revenue down 6.5%. Giant posted a revenue of $44.2 billion, or that's actually $1.38 billion U.S., for the first three quarters compared to the same period of last year. After-tax income for this was down 19.9% in 2015. Giant officials said in a press release that while the company has benefited from e-bike sales in Europe and a strong market in Japan, a poorly performing U.S. market still plagued by high inventories took a bite out of sales. They are very optimistic about what's going to happen in 2017. They think their new line of adventure e-bikes, which has grown in Germany and France, will do well in China and North America. So I think we're making the shift with e-bikes.
We've known that that's coming. You know, it's so interesting. If you look back at how long e-bikes have actually been out there, it seems like a really long time, but it's like that tipping point, you know, as Gladwell talks about.
When was the first e-bike?
Well, I remember Ed Benjamin talking about them probably 20, 25 years ago, that was going to be the future.
Small moped-type bikes have been around since they've had motors.
Oh, yeah,
so
absolutely.
So probably as soon as you could throw a battery on a bike, then you were good.
So my last story comes from Bicycle Retailer. It's about another concept store opening. This is Asos, which, of course, is the high-end Swiss apparel company. They are opening a concept store in London, Lugano, Switzerland. Asos of Switzerland has chosen London's posh Regent Street shopping district as the site of its first international concept store. The brand also operates a store near its headquarters in Lugano. The brand said the new store gives, quote, rise to a new era of specialized customer service for both professionals and cycling enthusiasts, end quote. The store at St. James Market includes an elliptical changing room complete with a sample of every garment in the collection. Customers will be able to test the products on a Guma racing bike before they leave the store. The store will house the full Asos apparel collection, helmets, eyewear, and accessories. Asos CEO Phil Duff said, wherever you live in the world, cycling is the best way to get from A to B, and we firmly believe that performance and style aren't mutually exclusive. London is the epicenter of fashion and the ever-growing buzz around cycling, and we're thrilled to bring our passion to Regent Street. So you can read the rest of the story at bicycleretailer.com from November 17th. That's our news for this week. We're going to take a real quick break. We'll be right back. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We're back, as promised, and let's head on over to Mallorca, Spain, where we're going to catch up with Guy Andrews and talk about his new book, Greg LeMond, Yellow Jersey Racer. Guy, thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Okay. Hello, Diane.
Dave Trendler, my buddy at Velo Press, always gets me the best books and the best authors. And this week, Greg LeMond's Yellow Jersey Racer showed up, and it is a gorgeous, gorgeous book. Do you love it?
I do love it. I'm very proud of it. But like any book, it kind of lives with you for a while, and you're quite happy to let it go. That's the nice thing about creating books, is that it's not it's a very sort of transient process where you kind of you get quite excited about the subject matter, you get really into the research, and you get really engaged with it, and then as time goes on, you want to just get the thing done.
So let's back up a little bit in time. You were the founder of Ruler Magazine, one of the most beautiful publications about cycling. You're the author of many books, including Mountain Bike Maintenance, Cyclist Training Manual, Rough Guide to Cycling, and you're a freelance writer. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you came to cycling and came to be so involved in the publication side of it.
I guess, like a lot of people, I stumbled into it, really. I spent a very long time at art college studying. When I left art college, the options for someone in the sort of mid-early 80s were pretty limited. So I guess I fell into it, really. I had a friend that worked for a mountain bike magazine. This is in the early, you know, the early days of mountain biking, sort of late 80s, early 90s. And he offered me a job working on this mountain bike magazine. So that's kind of how it started. I fell into it. I mean, it just so happened I really enjoyed writing about cycling, and that was always part of my life. I was a racer for many, many years. I used to go bicycle touring. I used to go mountain biking, everything that you do on a bike. So cycling was everything to me. I mean, I guess one of the reasons why, I know we're going to talk about the Greg LeMond book, but one of the reasons why the Greg LeMond book was particularly poignant for me is that was the first Tour de France I went to was 1986. So, and that was a trip with some friends. We just cycled from England to France and followed the tour for a week or so. So that was my baptism into cycling. And I don't know, I guess the adventure and the spirit of the thing just captivated me. So it's been my career pretty much ever since then.
Well, you know, it's nice when we can actually make a living doing what we love to do. So let's talk about the book. It is beautiful. It is a big coffee table edition book. It's hardbound. It's got tons of photographs, but it's the format that interested me most. You follow Greg's career from 1977 through 1994. It gives us a very broad and in-depth perspective, but you actually are more the editor. Explain how you began assembling it the way it's presented.
It's actually, it's quite a long story. When I first met Greg in the early days of Rouleur, actually, and I interviewed him for a story we did in a magazine. And I explained in the introduction to the book that a lot of the problems with that interview is I couldn't really print an awful lot of it because at the time it was quite a sensitive time for him, obviously with all the shenanigans with Lance Armstrong, etc. So, and I was really anxious not to want to do a book about that because I thought, unfortunately, what happened to Greg during the aftermath of his sort of spat with Armstrong was that everybody forgot what such an amazing bike racer he was. And what an incredible, not just an incredible physical ability, but a mental ability to actually race a bike, which, you know, people underestimate. It's not just having strong legs. You need to have the brain to go with it, of which he had. So, you know, and I suppose that kind of, that's where it started, the idea that rather than get Greg to tell the story, I mean, I don't know if anybody out there knows Greg personally. He's a very engaging character, but to get him to sit down for 10 minutes and talk about something is nigh on impossible. He's a very engaging, very very generous person with his time, but I wanted to tell the serious story about him as a bike racer, and of which we talked about his racing career for hours and hours and hours. That's where a lot of the captions for the book come from those conversations. But I realized that it wasn't a story. So what we decided to do was to speak to some people who raced with him, not just people who raced with him, but people who worked with him when he was a pro racer, and get them to tell the story. And that's how it came about. I mean, it was that simple. And I drew up a list of people I wanted to speak to, and that's pretty much who ended up in the book.
Anybody give you any resistance to sharing their stories about Greg and about the time that they raced with him?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, that was the incredible thing. I mean, I've said this to a few people I've spoken to about putting the book together, is everybody was willing to talk about, not just about Greg, but about that period. I wonder whether it's sort of, you know, there's enough water under the bridge now for people to be quite sort of starry-eyed and, you know, sort of looking back with rose-tinted glasses slightly about that period of racing. But no, nobody gave me any resistance. Everybody, I mean, as I said in the introduction in the book, I was actually quite astounded. You know, I mean, I raced a bike with some people who, you know, you get quite competitive and it's quite difficult to actually leave that behind you sometimes. But everybody I spoke to a man, had nothing but good things to say about Greg.
He is an interesting guy. The only time I actually was close to him was at a trade show back in Long Beach many years ago, right after he won his first tour. He's like a little boy in some ways. He's kind of adorable. Anyway, what were some of the surprising things you learned about him?
Yeah, I mean, I think racing, I was staggered by the amount of racing those guys did in those days.
You mean compared to now?
oh, God, I mean, unbelievable. You know, now they just have such an easy ride of it. I mean, fair enough, you know, that's probably how it should be. But if you look at someone like Sean Kelly or Greg even, I mean, not so much with Greg, but with Sean Kelly, I mean, it's no surprising at the end of the season they were just absolutely exhausted. I mean, they you know, 120, 130 days plus racing every year. It's unheard of now. I mean, you just wouldn't have that in an athlete of Greg's caliber. So that was the thing that surprised me the most, was talking to them about how hard it was. Not that you get that impression when they were interviewed by the TV or the press or whatever, because they all seem to love their sport. But it must have been a pretty unpleasant way to make a living. As from a point of view for Greg personally, I think Greg's quite shy. I got this impression from talking to Kathy, his wife, about him. He's quite shy about stuff, but he's actually very funny. He's got a very wicked sense of humour. And I think when you get to know him a little bit better, that really comes across. And that was one of the things that, for me, I guess it's one of the reasons why I decided I would do the book. I knew it would be a challenge, and it was, believe you me. But that's one of the reasons why I decided I wanted to do it, because I felt like his racing career hadn't been given a fair crack of the whip.
Well, it certainly is a thorough coverage when you look at the book. You know, a lot of people say, oh, big coffee table, it's just going to be pretty pictures. And there are beautiful photographs in here, but there's a lot of substance to the book. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Guy Andrews. He's in Mallorca, Spain. He is the, I would say, editor more than author of the Greg LeMond Yellow Jersey Racer. It's a new book from Velo Press. It is one of the gift ideas, I think, that any cyclist would be happy to get this year. What do you think the time period was that was the most difficult to assemble in the book? Was there one particular time period where, you know, it was more difficult to get the information?
I think for sure sort of 87, 88 were probably the hardest 2 years to do, because of obviously Greg getting shot, and how to deal with that was caused me quite a lot of sleepless nights, because I wanted to do it well. I didn't want to mess it up. So that part of the book was tricky, mostly because there weren't any pictures of him racing, because he didn't do much racing, obviously, because he'd been shot. So to keep the consistency in the book, where we wanted to try and have, you know, each year with, or at least, you know, 2 years together with plenty of photographs, that was quite difficult to do. But no, other than that, I think most of the years there was something going on that was positive, which I liked. You know, there was either a big win, or there was, you know, there was something involving Greg and the team that he was riding for that was significant. So, you know, I think the years when he, I mean, it's interesting as well, going back to Greg's personality, when you see pictures of him off the bike, when he's at the bike races, he's one of these characters that kind of, he's happiest when he's racing. You know, he was always happy when he was on the bike and, you know, doing what he was paid to do. It's quite interesting to see those pictures and how he is when he's relaxed and when he's not. And it's very interesting.
You know, it's almost to a picture, it's very difficult to find him not smiling. He seemed to be a happy guy.
Oh, very much so. Very much so, yeah.
So which time period, as you covered the book from the beginning to the end, did you think was the most interesting time for pure racing of the era?
Oh, crikey. I think, I mean, you know, you can't really talk about Greg and not talk about 85 and 86. I think they're probably the richest from the point of view of the story, but also from the point of view of the photography. I mean, a lot of the photographs from that period, I was very anxious to want to get stuff that hadn't really been seen before as much as possible, because I know a lot of the images from that era had already been seen. So I wanted to try and get as much of the backstory that I'd heard from Greg and other people about the fact, you know, the amount of pressure that he was under, for example, you know, and I hope that comes across with some of the photographs. You know, we wanted to try and find pictures that showed how stressful it was, really. Because that's the one thing that he does talk about, that was obviously a very difficult time for him. I mean, and for everybody involved in the team, it was very unique. That period of time between sort of, as I say, probably between the early part of 85 and after the Tour de France in 86.
It's a pretty amazing recovery.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite story that other people may never have heard that shows up, just to give the listeners a flavor of the book?
I really like the story by Otto, his soigneur, who's his soigneur, and Otto Giacomo, who's his soigneur in his later part of his career, actually came over after he was shot, came over to Europe with Greg, and they spent a lot of time together. And Otto he's such a lovely man. He's a very, very sweet guy. And just the stories he'd tell, there was a story he told about Greg coming around one day to the house where he was living in Belgium. And obviously a Mexican in Belgium in those days was quite a rarity. So Otto used to cook Mexican food, and Greg was a big fan and still is of Mexican food. So, you know, I really love that story. It's a very simple story, but it was just about Otto cooking him sort of a beef cheek taco in the kitchen in Belgium. And it's just, for me, for someone who fully appreciates what it's like, you know, to sort of be an American detached away from their homeland, but also to have that whole idea that, you know, they're in Belgium doing this, which all sounded very, very strange. But I don't know. I like that story. I think that story is great. I mean, I also think obviously Shelley Versus as well tells some great stories about Greg. I mean, I actually think everybody had something, you know, something quite unique, quite different to tell about Greg. So I don't know. I hope that comes across. I hope this. I mean, there's some stuff that obviously people may have read before, but you know, it's. I hope there's something in there for everyone.
Oh, I believe there is. If you like cycling and if you like bike racing, there's definitely something in there for everyone. The last thing I want to talk about is what's going on with Greg now. Do you keep in touch with him at all?
Yeah. We launched the book in Chicago a month or so ago now. As I say, Greg is a very unique character in that he's always up to something. He's always, you know, there's always a new venture, and his latest venture sounds to me to be probably one of the most exciting he's been involved in since he retired, which is he's involved with a carbon fiber composites development company down in the South States. So he's obviously very, very busy with that. I hope we have to work together again, but this book took you know, the best part of 3 years from sort of beginning to end, and actually strangely most of the contact I had over those 3 years was with Kathy rather than with Greg, so you know I feel I got to know them both pretty well over those years, and I hope that comes across in the book as well.
The book is very personal and personable. What I want to remind our listeners is that the book is Greg LeMond, Yellow Jersey Racer. It is edited by Guy Andrews. It is a beautifully put together book, and it would be a wonderful holiday gift if you want to add to your library collection. And we have a huge collection of cycling books at our house. I hope you have a wonderful holiday. Thank you so much for putting this book out there. I think it's a great sort of tribute to Greg LeMond and to the time that he was our American hero.
Great. Thank you, Diane. Thanks so much.
All right. You have a wonderful holiday. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Guy Andrews talked with me from Mallorca, Spain, about his new book, Greg LeMond, Yellow Jersey Racer. He is the editor of the book. I'm telling you, the book weighs like 4 pounds. It is huge. It is beautiful. I'd also like to thank Bill Strickland, editor-in-chief of Bicycling Magazine, for joining me this week. And I hope that everyone had a great holiday. If you have a chance, you know what to do. Go for a ride. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions, with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.